phobia, they're not only losing that minority vote, but they're losing many other people as well.
Labour's membership increased significantly during former party leader Jeremy Corbyn's term, swelling to more than 500,000. The lifelong socialist eventually handed over power following years of stiff rebellions from right-wing Labour MPs, who now head the party. The latest figures raise serious doubts of whether current leader Sir Keir Starmer could win an election when he can't even win the hearts of Labour's own membership. Robert Carter, London.
One year ago, following the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan, the US froze about $7 billion in Afghan central bank assets and cut major international funding to the country. The measure, which pushed the Afghan economy to collapse, faced backlash from inside and outside Afghanistan. In February, US President Joe Biden signed an order, splitting Afghan assets between relief aid to Afghanistan and 9/11 victims. On Tuesday, nearly 80 family members of 9/11 victims sent a letter to Biden, saying the money belongs to Afghans, urging him to release the money without delay.
In fact, no law, regulation or moral orders permits a country to freeze the reserves of another country and create a situation where the owners of the money face economic suffering. The money, which is blocked by the US and its allies, belongs to the people of Afghanistan. As I mentioned, based on the international laws and moral norms, the US doesn't have the right to decide on Afghan assets, be it keeping the money or splitting it between 9/11 victims.
In Afghanistan, more and more people are going without job and cash, as the US sanctions have paralyzed the public economy. Frustrated Afghans call for the release of Afghanistan's central bank assets and solidarity from the international community.
The US should solve its disputes with the Taliban. Why is it punishing poor Afghan people? Both sides have had their battle and agreement. Today, the U.S. is stealing that piece of bread of ours which was supposed to fill the stomachs of our children. Why is the U.S. creating this dire situation which everyone is hungry and poor? In addition, we have been the victims of the terrorism and we can't pay the price for 9/11.
Majority of the Afghan population is in need of humanitarian assistance. More than half of Afghans are going hungry and more than 1 million children are severely malnourished. The humanitarian situation in Afghanistan is getting worse day by day, and the country needs its frozen funds for an economic recovery. It remains to be seen when Washington opens its eyes on the miseries of Afghans and returns their money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Shuttered stations and picket lines. Another day of severe disruption in the British capital.
We're just outside an underground station in West London, usually a very busy station, but today it is closed. The same thing or very limited service across many different stations in London for 24 hours.
It comes a day after another mass walkout of railway workers. The advice from the authorities, avoid traveling on the tube if possible.
I'm with them because it's true, when you're 60, why should you retire? I mean, why should they give you redundancy?
I mean, the cost of living's going up and all that. They're asking for a fair thing. Same in any job. They're offering silly things like 3% when inflation now is 10%. So I'm fully behind them.
I understand the people. That's normal. They are workers. They need more money, of course. Everything is rising.
A major bus walkout will also affect travel in parts of the capital. While a second day of rail strikes is expected to disrupt services around the country on Saturday. Almost all are part of widespread stoppages in recent months organized mainly by the National Union of Railway, Maritime and Transport Workers, locked in a face-off with the government over modernizing changes, wages and pensions, among other things.
People in this country are fed up with low pay. Many millions of people have had not a proper pay deal for a decade. So public sector workers in healthcare, education, transport, all sorts of services have been subjected to pay cuts and rampant inflation.
The ongoing strikes are inspiring other public sector workers such as nurses and teachers, to do the same in the face of rampant inflation forecast to top 13% this year.
In the next few months, you're bound to see a convergence of trade unions all taking very direct action, calling their members on strike in an effort to protect the cost of living increases and the deterioration of wages that we've seen for workers across the country.
The government has threatened to use emergency powers to block future strikes. The unions, on the other hand, say they're not relenting unless they receive new deals they deem acceptable. Saeed Puriza, London.
Turkish main opposition party CHP has criticized the government for, quote, its double standards in regards with the Palestinian cause. The reaction was made after Turkey announced that it will appoint an ambassador to Israel, 4 years after Ankara cut its ties with the regime over the killing of 60 Palestinians by Israeli forces during a protest on the Gaza border. Deputy chairman of CHP parliamentary bloc Engin Özkoç said, it seems AKP has not heard about Israel's latest aggression in Gaza, adding the government has forgotten its promises to Palestinians.
Erdogan used to describe Israel as a child killer and a terrorist regime. Since the Marmara incident in 2010, Erdogan set conditions for normalizing relations with Israel. Those conditions weren't met, but what has changed now? Israel's killing of Palestinian children continues and has not stopped. A week ago, Palestinian children were killed in Gaza by Israel. Hasn't AKP heard about Israel's killing of children in Gaza in the latest Israeli attack? And now, they are rushing to normalize relations with Israel? They deal with the file in two different ways, and they have forgotten their promises to the Palestinians and our people as well.
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu said Turkey is not giving up on the Palestinian cause. However, it is important for their messages to be conveyed directly through the ambassadors. For the past few months, Turkey and Israel have been trying to normalize ties. Back in March, they announced a new era in their relations after the Israeli president paid a visit to Ankara and met Erdogan. Turkish people have always criticized the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian land. They have repeatedly taken to the streets to protest against the Israeli aggression in the Gaza Strip. While anti-Israeli sentiment runs high in Turkey, analysts say Ankara's whole foreign policy is changing, with this normalization being part of a new political strategy taken by the Erdogan administration. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Another mass walkout bringing the UK's railway network to a grinding halt, causing major disruptions. Tens of thousands of signalers, maintenance workers, ticket collectors fighting for their rights as negotiations with the government for better pay and conditions hit the buffers.
I support the workers that are striking.
We're being inconvenienced, but they're being treated unequally.
Many rail employees, often working unsocial hours in a high-pressure environment, say they have seen no pay rise in 3 years, as the specter of soaring inflation, predicted to surpass 13% over the next year, looms over negotiations. The Conservative government has offered a below-inflation pay rise and accuses the unions organizing the strikes of taking the country for ransom. Despite that, public support for the strikes is on the rise.
I'm quite sympathetic to the train strikes and actually the other industrial unrest, because it comes on the back of minimal increase in wages over a long period of time, a pay freeze much more recently, and an offer which is frankly way, way, way below the current rate of inflation.
Stoking the public ire, comments by Conservative Prime Ministerial hopeful Liz Truss, who has pledged to restrict the ability of public sector workers to strike.
Liz Truss is seeking to take away human rights and the ability of the democratic right of people to express themselves through their trade unions and industrial action, which is one of the pillars of our democracy. It's only repressive regimes that stop people going on strike and stop them expressing themselves and stop them rebalancing the power in the workplace through their trade unions.
The opposition Labour Party, which receives funding from several trade unions itself, has also come under fire for failing to support the walkouts. The rail strikes, which also include London's underground and overground network, have set off a wave of industrial action that is set to get bigger, with teachers, health workers, and even barristers planning their own strikes.
Britain's so-called summer of discontent seems well underway, with a general strike more likely now than ever before, and with the railway workers in the eye of the storm. Saipur is up, London.
The Israeli military shut down seven Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. Early on Thursday, the Israeli military raided occupied Ramallah and broke into the offices of the organizations. The offices were ransacked and their equipment confiscated. Doors were welded shut with an Israeli military order posted on them declaring the organizations unlawful. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless.
They are targeting by the seven organizations. They are targeting the civil society sector in Palestine and the human rights sector in general. So the message was any organization talked about, exposed the Israeli policy, talked about the Israeli crimes will be targeted and will be silent. Again, the message also for the international organizations and, of course, also for the EU states, those who are rejected the Israeli allegation against the organizations. This is a message that Israel is above the law.
Israel has outlawed six of these NGOs, which were labeled as terrorist organizations in October 2021, and accused them of funneling donor aid to militants and had ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a Palestinian left-wing movement. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bissan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees.
We will continue our work. Work in this field, it's not a job. It's not a job. The Israelis continue their atrocities, their oppression against us, against the rest of the civil society organizations here. But this will not stop us, and this will not push us back, and we will not give up, and we will continue. We know that we pay price, maybe personal price, maybe different kind of a price, but we are ready to defend, to fight for the principles that we do believe.
The United Nations Human Rights Office has meanwhile expressed alarm at Israel's arbitrary closure of organizations and called on Israel to immediately reverse these decisions, reiterating the High Commissioner's call to revoke the designations of the organizations as terrorist and unlawful.
The Israeli regime has added to its illegal practices which aim to silence the Palestinian people. Today, not only does it continue to suppress Palestinian people, the regime also quells these organizations and human rights advocates. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Iranian Minister for Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi, along with the delegation of 57 dignitaries from Iran, visited Islamabad on the sidelines of 21st session of Pak-Iran Joint Economic Commission. During the two-day visit, the Iranian delegation met Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and discussed the bilateral ties between the two countries. Pakistan's Foreign Minister underlined the need to fully utilize the existing potential between Islamabad and Tehran in energy and air links. Addressing a press conference with the Iranian Roads and Urban Development Minister, Pakistan's Minister for Commerce, Naveed Qamar, said both sides have agreed to start negotiations on transit agreements that will allow the movement of goods without any additional taxes or tariffs.
We agreed on time frames for the PTA, which is to be negotiated between the two countries, and an ambitious target of 6 months has been set for that process.
The visiting Iranian minister, Rustam Qasimi, said The 21st session of Pakistan-Iran Joint Economic Commission offers new avenues for expanding bilateral ties between Pakistan and Iran. He noted, in order to increase bilateral trade, both sides are ready to establish border markets, which will later be made free economic zones to enable investors of both countries to set up their industries for import and export purposes.
I believe that the implementation of these agreements will play a significant role in raising the quality of life of the people of the two sides, especially the border markets, transportation, and the exchange of goods between the two countries.
Islamabad has assured Tehran that it is committed to taking all possible measures to increase bilateral trade volume to the level of $5 billion in near future.
Besides signing different MOUs in the fields of transport, trade, and business, both Pakistan and Iran also stressed the need of making visa conditions easier to facilitate the traders and visitors from both sides. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompass the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Israeli army stormed the headquarters of seven Palestinian NGOs in Ramallah and declared them closed. The move came after the military designated these organizations as terror groups. This is while the NGOs have accused Israel of seeking to silence criticism and human rights violations against Palestinians. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether the NGOs are right in their accusations against Israel, or is Israel justified in the closures of these NGOs?
The Israeli military shut down seven Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. Early on Thursday, the Israeli military raided occupied Ramallah and broke into the offices of the organizations. The offices were ransacked and their equipment confiscated. Doors were welded shut with an Israeli military order posted on them declaring the organizations unlawful. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless.
They are targeting by the seven organizations, they are targeting the civil society sector in Palestine and the human rights sector in general. So the message was, any organization talked about, exposed the Israeli policy, talked about the Israeli crimes will be targeted and will be silent. Again, the message also for the international organizations and, of course, also for the EU states, those who are rejected the Israeli allegation against the organizations. This is a message that Israel is above the law.
Israel has outlawed six of these NGOs, which were labeled as terrorist organizations in October 2021, and accused them of funneling donor aid to militants and had ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a Palestinian left-wing movement. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bisan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees.
We will continue our work. Work in this field, it's not a job. the Israelis continue their atrocities, their oppression against us, against the rest of the civil society organizations here. But this will not stop us, and this will not push us back, and we will not give up, and we will continue. We know that we pay price, maybe personal price, maybe different kind of a price, but we are ready to defend, to fight for the principles that we do believe.
The United Nations Human Rights Office has meanwhile expressed alarm at Israel's arbitrary closure of organizations and called on Israel to immediately reverse these decisions, reiterating the High Commissioner's call to revoke the designations of the organizations as terrorist and unlawful.
The Israeli regime has added to its illegal practices which aim to silence the Palestinian people. Today, not only does it continue to suppress Palestinian people, the regime also quells these organizations and human rights advocates. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us for this program, Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign joins us from Edinburgh. We also have Kevin Barrett, an author and Middle East expert, joining us from Madison. Mick Napier, I'll first start with you. Welcome to you both, however. Mick Napier, we are looking at Israel shutting down seven Palestinian NGOs, in which Israel said the groups had ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which it says has carried out attacks against Israelis. Do you see any justification in Israel shutting down these seven NGOs?
Well, connected, associated with, these are the vaguest terms possible. Look, when they do this, then the focus has shifted to basically an evidence-free debate and discussion about whether these Palestinian NGOs are terrorists. The allegation's ludicrous, but it takes, but the actual allegation being made and being picked up in the media around the world shifts the focus away from Israel's terroristic behavior, mass incarceration, shootings, house demolitions, and so on, and takes us from a focus on real violations of human rights and terrorism to a fantasy allegation of terrorism, because these organizations, their work is recognized by European Union bodies, they receive some funding in order to tell the truth, in order to research and to report on Israel's crimes, mass incarceration, shoot to kill, and so on. So although it's preposterous, it's very similar to the campaigns in Western countries where allegations of, without any evidence, that people who are pro-Palestine are anti-Semitic, however absurd, takes the discussion away from what Israel is doing, and that's the whole purpose of it. They expect certain organizations in the West to condemn this. Nobody will take any punitive action against Israel, but also Israel's allies will go silent. They'll be quiet about this because it's completely indefensible. And even those people who rarely speak up for human rights, who might be prepared even to condemn Saudi Arabia for a crime against this young woman, I mean, preposterous and savage, they will remain silent with these in the face of these attacks against Palestinian NGOs. Mm. The bottom line is the Western governments which support Israel will condemn resistance of any form from the Palestinians, whether that be armed resistance or political non-violent resistance. You know, I'm reminded of when Tony Blair called for the release of one single prisoner which the Palestinians had taken from the occupation forces, while thousands of Palestinians languishing in Israeli dungeons, he called not for their release at all, even those who were denied even the fig leaf of a trial. So one rule for the Israelis, one rule for the Palestinians, and although the Israelis can do no wrong in the eyes of Tony Blair and Boris Johnson and Biden, really it seems as if the Palestinians can do no right, however noble, however self-sacrificing, however justified by the evidence, is the work of these excellent NGOs. So excellent that it's recognized even by parts of governments in Europe, okay, which are Israeli allies.
Yeah, exactly. But they have come out, and they have, these European countries actually, Kevin Barrett, have come out, and they have condemned, they haven't condemned, I take that back, I have to be very careful here, the words, or the way they describe it, deeply concerned. As they said, a worrying reduction of space for civil society. But it's interesting that they have come out somewhat harshly critiquing what Israel has done, because Israel has said these declared organizations receive large sums of money from European countries using a variety of forgery and deceit. So that doesn't quite go together with the way that the European countries have reacted. What's your reading into that?
Well, the European countries know very well that these are totally respectable human rights groups that are complying with all kinds of Western standards and norms and basically kowtowing to the whole Western neoliberal ideology, which poses as the one and only supreme arbiter and defender of all forms of human rights, which is what gives it its supposed monopoly on legitimacy throughout the entire world. You know, this is a hegemonic ideology that the West uses to dominate the rest of the planet. And so these European groups are actually not displeased to have Palestinians echoing that ideology. And so they do support this kind of work to a certain extent, as I suppose they should. But then when the Israelis reveal the complete hollowness and the sham of the way this ideology of human rights actually gets applied on the ground in occupied Palestine, where the Palestinians are being subjected to nonstop terrorism and genocide, then, of course, the Europeans simply whimper a bit and say that they're a little bit concerned and so on and so forth, but they do nothing that actually prevents the Israelis from shutting these organizations down and from continuing to commit the kinds of terrorist crimes and atrocities and slow-motion genocide which these groups have been documenting. So there's a kind of built-in hypocrisy to the system. The so-called world community, so the self-styled world community, which is actually a neoliberal global takeover project run from the biggest banks in London and New York, those folks are using liberalism and human rights discourse as their excuse for what they do. And in fact, the reality is that these people who uh-huh. rule the world from their bank offices are the world's worst violators of human rights, and they're supporting this terrorism and genocide in Palestine. And so the human rights groups that speak out supposedly lukewarmly defending what these groups that got shut sure. down are doing are just playing their role in a much larger drama.
Well, I'm a bit confused here, McNabb, here, because if I understood you correctly, you said that the European countries are not as vocal, but it seems like they are on this case when you have these countries like Belgium, Denmark, France, Germany, Ireland, Italy, the Netherlands, Spain, and Sweden, the nine European Union countries. They are saying that these actions are not acceptable, and they have cited a lack of evidence for what Israel has done, and furthermore, they said that they are not going to actually abide by what Israel has decided to do. It's interesting that they're coming out and they're actually being vocal about this, but where were they when You had over 16 Palestinian children and women who were killed in the recent Israeli war. Why don't they speak about those types of things and atrocities when they occur?
I mean, exactly. Exactly. Look, Israel is a kind of attack dog in the Middle East for the West, for America and Europe. A kind of insurance policy if any local governments become too independently minded. But sometimes the attack dog goes too far and it kind of turns around and bites the person holding the lead. And, you know, Macron and others don't like it when Israel steals foreign aid, for aid to the Palestinians, which the EU has donated, which happens quite often, or attacks clients or allies of the EU inside the Palestinian movement. Israel's going too far. Some of them, I mean, the relationship can sometimes be a little bit tense because some of the Western chancelleries think that Israel's gone a little bit crazy and they'll be prepared to criticize them. But when push comes to shove, as your other speaker has said, and as you've said, when push comes to shove, they remain silent when Israel massacres Palestinians. And therefore to be annoyed, to be critical of what Israel's done now is very, very feeble indeed. Look, essentially, these Palestinians have set up NGOs which try to incorporate Western values in order to say to the Europeans, look what we are doing. It's within your system of values, therefore you should support us. But this misses a key point. You know, there were some North American Indians, native people, who adopted Christianity, thinking that this would protect them from being dispossessed. But the land was wanted. The settlers wanted the land, and it made no difference how the natives behaved. They were surplus to requirements, and they had to be ethnically cleansed. Uh-huh. And it's the same with the Palestinians. Even if they behave in the best traditions, the traditions of Swedish social democracy, they are surplus to Israeli requirements, and nothing they can do will exempt them from the Zionist plan to expel them from Palestine, and until that becomes possible, to make life as difficult as possible. So this fits into the Zionist playbook, but it also fits into the occasional criticisms you get from Europe of sure. Israeli excesses.
Well, looking at the U.S. side, Kevin Barrett, the U.S. has actually, through a spokesperson, said that you need to give us some good reasons. The U.S. has said to Israel, you need to give us some reasoning behind this. And Israel has said, well, because they're associated with a terrorist organization, PFLP, and also them calling some of these NGOs terrorist entities themselves. You had 20 members of U.S. Congress actually saying that Biden administration should reject these designations. But that goes against the most recent trip that Biden made to Israel, where it pledged to shield Israel from accountability when it comes to, for example, the ICC or at the U.N. So these two don't go together, do they?
Well, no, there's a difference here, a split in the ruling elite between people like Biden, who basically is forced to dance the tune of the Zionist power states, the White House, the national security constitutions of the deep government, and these people who get elected in sort of left-leaning districts in various big cities of places like Detroit, Minneapolis, and so on. These people in Congress are much more willing to actually kind of walk the walk with the human rights ideology and recognize what's really going on in occupied Palestine and speak a little bit of truth about it every now and then. So, yeah, there is that split, and it leads to kind of different noises coming from different ends of the Democratic Party. But Biden has proved by his rhetoric against the Saudis and so on when he was running for office, and then his behavior when he goes and kisses the ring of Mohammed bin Salman, and then also the Zionist leadership, that he is just as much a pawn and a puppet of those leaders as any other American president. And unfortunately, it's always going to be that way because the U.S. is not a democracy. It's an oligarchy run by a deep state, ultimately run by the people who print the money. And those people are ethnically and otherwise tied to the genocidal regime in Tel Aviv. And they're going to keep on running the world the way they see fit until we manage to rise up and overthrow them, which is what we should all be working on at every moment.
Well, looking at the NGOs, McNabb, here. They worked in fields like human rights, of course, prisoner support, or children's rights and health care. But these three particular ones that I first stated are issues that Israel has a problem with. They detain children, they're poor on their human rights, obviously, and of course, when it comes to prisoners, we know what's going on with that. So do you think this was a targeted act by Israel in order to shut them down and overall trying to silence any type of critique that may be leveled against them or reporting of human rights violations that are occurring in the occupied territories?
Oh, yes. I mean, from the Israeli side, there's no mystery. Israel wants to close down Palestinian society. It wants to kill those who resist by armed means, and it wants to jail anybody who resists politically. I mean, if you want to tell the truth about what happened to the Palestinians in 48, if you want to agitate for the democratic rights that are the official ruling ideas in Britain and America and so on, the right to live wherever you want in an area and so on, if you have the money, that's called incitement. So actually talking about your rights is a crime in Israel. It's very difficult, and it's something which the Western elites constantly struggle with. How can they whitewash Israel, given that what Israel is doing runs counter to their official ideas? They always manage to succeed. Look, when Biden was in Palestine last time, the Americans were asked about Shireen Abu Akleh, murdered by an Israeli sniper. Everybody knows who killed him. The dogs in the street know who killed Shireen Abu Akleh. But for the Americans, there's no smoking gun. They covered up even that, not by saying Israel didn't do it, but by saying we can't be sure. So there's no limit to how America and the European Union will protect Israel. But sometimes Israel goes a little bit too far, and sometimes some elements in our governments, politicians think that the attack dog has to, the leash has to be tugged. They have to be told who's the master here. So I think that's what we're seeing. Almost everything that attack dog does will be defended or will be greeted with complete silence if it's indefensible. But from time to time, there will be mild criticism, as long as there is no question of sanctions and punishment of Israel to accompany those criticism. That's the golden rule, which unites politicians right across Europe and North America, with a very, very few honorable exceptions.
Well, to zoom in a little bit more about these NGOs, since we haven't, one of them, Kevin Barrett, is by the name of Adamir, which follows the basis criminalization of organizations where the international community failed to hold Israel accountable, in which it says that, for example, Israel has, and this has encouraged, if not provoked, Israel to go after it. Or another one, such as Al-Haq, of which it has said that in that case, when it guides the families of prisoners, that it's providing support. Maybe Israel is paranoid about these organizations for one reason or another, and it went after shutting them down in these numbers because it maybe wants to increase the violations against Palestinians. Could that be a possibility?
Well, yeah, Israel, of course, doesn't want to face any kind of opposition as it runs roughshod over the rights of Palestinians. And these kinds of groups like Al-Haq that organize with the Palestinian prisoners actually help maintain morale among those resistance people, you know, people who are demonstrating, people who are one way or another resisting this genocide. And the fact that there are these kinds of organizations that try to work on their behalf, that try to give some kind of voice to their plight in the world, no matter how restricted that voice is, at least that there's a certain amount of efficacy in terms of helping the world understand what's going on. And so they are seen as obstacles and impediments to the Zionist genocide project. And in fact, the Zionists, in some ways, I think, fear this kind of activity even more than they fear most forms of armed resistance, because at this point, Most of the paths to successful armed resistance are at least temporarily blocked. But there is this huge contradiction between the West's obsession with human rights and what's actually happening on the ground in Palestine. And so groups like these that are building bridges to the Western human rights groups are seen as a threat in the medium and long term by the Zionists in terms of the way that the public opinion has been affected. Even Jewish public opinion here in the United States has radically changed over the past generation. Now the younger Jewish Americans are vastly more skeptical about the Zionist entity. I think there was a poll showing that over a third of them agree that Israel is committing genocide and is an apartheid state. So the Zionists see they're losing legitimacy, and shutting down these organizations may be a desperate attempt to try to shore up their legitimacy by silencing those who are questioning it.
My last question does go for another one of these organizations, Defense for Children International Palestine, McNapp here, in less than a minute. This is an organization that is for children's rights. I'm looking at the activities, and Israel has called its members terrorists for protecting and defending Palestinian children's rights. Can you see any logic in there? Less than a minute, please.
No logic whatsoever. Israel has to cover up what it does to the greatest extent possible. It has to repress public opinion across Europe and North America, which is increasingly hostile, as our guest has pointed out, to what Israel does. And the task of repressing that public opinion together with governments, that is made more difficult by Al-Haq and by Defense for Children International. When Israel kills 551 children during Operation Protective Edge, when it killed all those to shut down DCI, they have to do it because they fear what these organizations can do in informing Western public opinion.
Thank you very much for that. Mick Napier, Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Kevin Barrett, thank you, author and Middle East expert from Madison. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavoy and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that Imam Khomeini continued his struggles against the Pahlavi regime, even in exile in Iraq. It was also said that, due to the pressures of the regime, the Imam asked his wife to return to Iran, but she rejected and didn't leave her husband alone. Today, you will hear the events after the demise of Imam Khomeini's elder son, Haj Aqa Mustafa. Stay tuned, please. The suspicious death of Imam Khomeini's elder son, Haj Aqa Mustafa, was one of the bitter events during his exile in Iraq. This was not just due to the son and father relation and love. As a matter of fact, the Imam always praised his son's scientific and spiritual position, so that he said on his death, Mustafa was the future hope of Islam. The Imam's wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, says on the event, on Sunday, 1st of Aban, we had not got up when the Imam came to us and called Ahmad and said that someone has telephoned from Mustafa's house and asked for help. He told Ahmad to go and see if Ma'sume needed help. Ma'sume, Mustafa's wife, had a stomachache the night before, and the Imam knew it. Ahmad immediately went to his brother's home. I got up too and went to Mustafa's home. There was a car at the door, which went away instantly. I ran after the car and saw that it entered the hospital. The doorkeeper didn't let me in and asked who I was. I said that I was with the patient. He said in cold blood that he had already died. The Imam's wife continues, hearing the news of Mustafa's death from the doorkeeper made me impatient and I fell on the ground. As he saw me, he asked, "What is your relation with him?" I answered, "I am his mother." Then he allowed me in and I understood that I had lost my dear son Mustafa. I don't know how I got back home. I cried nearly till the evening when the Imam came to Mustafa's home. Upon seeing him, I lost my patience and said, "Do you see what has happened?" He told me, "Be patient for God's sake. I know that it is hard, but if you consider it for the God's sake, it will be easy to tolerate. God will make it easy to tolerate this disaster." I said, "I cannot, sir. I have endured much hardship, but I cannot endure this one." The Imam put his hands on his wife's shoulder and said, "I know, but be patient for God's sake." Imam Khomeini's wife was very sad at Haj Agha Mustafa's suspicious demise. Moreover, she was worried about the Imam's health as he was seriously under spiritual pressure at the event. After the death of the Imam's elder son, women would come to the Imam's home for extending condolences. But the Imam's wife was worried about answering the questions of the visitors, as some of them were the members of the Shah Intelligence Service, SAVAK, or the Iraqi Intelligence Service, to get information from the Imam's home. The body of Haj Agha Mustafa was buried the day after. Although Imam Khomeini was very sad at the event, he said that his death was one of the hidden favors of God. The news of Haj Agha Mustafa's death soon spread across Iran and all seminaries in Qom, Mashhad, Isfahan, Shiraz, and Tabriz were closed. Thus, the name of Imam Khomeini could be heard again after 13 years of prohibition. This ignited people's sentiments, and some of the preachers likened Imam Khomeini to Prophet Abraham, as he had passed through divine tests successfully and patiently. Mourning ceremonies were held throughout the country until the 40th day of Haj Agha Mustafa's death. These ceremonies were indeed good opportunities for political protest against the regime. After the 40th day, Imam Khomeini wrote three letters in response to those who had condoled with him. He had written in the letters that, "Although Mustafa's death is very bitter, it is not comparable with the calamities and oppressions that the regime enforces on the people." Imam Khomeini's answer to the condolences of great ulema was indeed a political protest against the Shah. It soon was spread among people and angered the regime. The Shah used to keep silent toward the reports of Savak, but as he read the Imam's statement, he got very angry and ordered several articles to be published in response to the statement. Thus, the article, Iran and the Red and Black Colonialism, was published on Etelaat newspaper with the pen name of Rashidi Mutlaq. The article had insulted Imam Khomeini and it kindled people's hatred against the regime. Seminaries were closed and the seminary students gathered at the homes of the sources of emulation. Therefore, Qom was the scene of popular protest rallies, which led to the martyrdom of a very few people by security forces. This infuriated the people in various cities and led to the formation of demonstrations in chain 40th days, which resulted in the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.